Okay, good. Oh, right. Good morning. So today I'm planning on doing exam review, which is you tell me what you want reviewed, otherwise I won't talk about it, or what questions about the exam that I'm able to answer you want answered. So I'll just take a bunch of questions and I'll answer them in some order, and then I'll take another bunch of questions if we still have more time. Yes.
Is virtual memory going to be on it?
Exam, okay.
Everything on the last quiz.
Everything on the last quiz, okay. Yeah. Exam format. Yeah.
Can we go over the schedule?
Okay. Comparing scheduling methods. Yeah.
The cache coherency section.
Cache coherency. Yeah. Mutex versus spinlock. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. Semaphores versus monitors. Okay. Any? Yeah. Okay. Implementing monitor with semaphores. Okay. Yeah.
Will you, I don't know if it's too broad, can we go over like some relevant
scheduling? I would like to be more specific.
How would the completely fair scheduler?
What any, okay. Completely fair scheduler. Okay. Anything else? Or over there?
How to
okay. And okay, so we'll sort these. So we have a bunch of concurrency. So virtual memory. Okay, so first I'll do the logistics ones. Everything in lecture up to and including last week is on the exam. Also, everything we did in assignments might be on the exam. So, like, so that does it. Exam format is mostly short answer or multiple choice. Some one sentence answers, like explain something in one sentence or describe what would happen in one sentence or describe why you should or shouldn't do this in one sentence or something like that. And maybe a code question that is not fill in the blank, depending on whether we feel there's time. Like, we'd like to ask one, but not if it means we can't ask other questions. And I'm gonna try to make the exam reasonable to complete in 75 minutes. So, tentatively it looks like that probably won't fit, but we might shuffle questions around so it does, like, move other questions. But mostly short answer, multiple choice, and some, like, one sentence explain something answers. Yeah.
We will not tell you what the code question is about if there is a code question.
You can guess that there are two major topics we cover which would be good to ask code questions about, and those are the two things that made for probably the hardest assignments, namely threading and the POSIX API for processes and file descriptors. Yeah.
But it won't be like string parsing or something.
Yes, it will be a code question about things you should know from lecture in this class, not some prior class. Okay, so the last quiz was on virtual memory, so let me pull up
the last quiz, so which was, so virtual memory. I suppose I should first look to see which quiz questions are actually problems on the last quiz. Okay, so we'll gloss over the third and not. So I'll start with the last question, which is, says that a system uses copy on write to implement fork. A process forks, then modifies addresses. So on its stack. And the system has 4K pages. There's some other information specified, but it turns out this is all you actually need to know. And the question asks, so, you know, Q4. How many new pages are allocated besides and the child, I believe, modifies. Besides page table pages and ones used by the kernel. So any questions on that setup? Okay. So the idea of copy on write is that we only copy things if they're written to. As far as the user data. We obviously have to copy like the struct proc. Like that's not part of copy on write, it's duplicating that generally. And even if it was, we've excluded it from the question. And the page tables, we're kind of ambiguous about that, but we've excluded it from the question whether we allocate new space for the page table. So the only question is, are we allocating new space for user data? And if we don't change it, we only need one copy of it for both processes. And it's gonna be the same copy we started with, so we don't need a new one. So the question is, how many pages are changed, is what this is really asking. And to know that, we should know what pages are these. And this is, and if we have 4K pages, this means that the last 12 bits are the page offset, which is equal to 3 hexadecimal nibbles. So I can quickly say virtual page numbers 0x7FFE through 0x7FFF, which is two virtual pages, because there's two virtual page numbers among all those addresses that were changed. So those are the only pages we actually need to copy. We need to copy the whole thing because we can't like make a page table entry for the last part of this page. And we need to have the whole page available to write to if we have a valid page table entry for it. And so that gives us an answer of, so two pages to copy, the one for 0x7FFE and for 0x7FFF. And we need to, since we're copying them, we need a place to copy them to. That's where we're allocating two new pages. So any questions about this? Yeah. So since the last 12 bits are the page offset, that means that if I take the address FEFF8, then this part is the page offset, and that means the rest must be the virtual page number. Any other questions? Yeah. Yes, because remember it's triggered by you try to write to that address, and when we return from the page fault handler, we want the write to actually happen. And the only way that's going to happen is if we make the new pages valid in one of the page tables. Yeah.
So, like, if you share the memory with your processes, does that mean that both processes have the same address space?
So, when we have shared memory.
So on the copy on right, we're sharing memory between two processes. Does that mean, like, both of them have the same address space?
So, the question is immediately after the fork, do both of the processes have the same address space? And the answer is, in a technical sense, yes, because like everything in their page tables could be exactly the same at that point. However, if they write to anything whatsoever, that will change. But immediately afterwards, everything in their page table is read-only and exactly the same. Okay, so that's question 4, and let's skip up to question 1. So question 1 is, how much space do we need to have a page table that stores valid mappings for addresses 0x8000 through 0x8000 plus 224 megabytes? And this is assuming x86's page table. X32-bit x86 is page table layout as used by. Where did I put that? What? Okay. Oh, okay, that's what I did. Oh, I just put this right in the middle. Great, okay. Assuming x32's page table layout. So, for this, so the question should be, how many pages is 224 meg? So 224 meg is, and so we take, we divide by 4k, and we get 5, 7, 3, let's divide properly by 4k, and we get 56 pages. Okay, so that's, oh, wow. Yeah. 56. Oh, right. 5 by 4K. Sorry, we divide by 4K, we get, 56K pages. 56K pages. That's the important thing there. And 56K pages. And we have 1K pages per second level page table. So 4K bytes. So to be clear, it's 224 meg divided by 4 kilobytes per page gives us 56 times 2 to the 10th pages. Then we have 1K pages per second level page table, where K in this case is 1024, because we have 2 to the 10 pages, because 10 bits are used to find where in the second level table to go. So we need 56 second level tables, 56 and not 57, because 0x00 starts, corresponds to the beginning of a second level table, because the last 10 bits of its BPN are 0. Yeah. Okay, so we have 56 second level tables, and we need to have a pointers to these, and that's going to be in a first level table. Yeah.
How do you get 56
pages? So we have 56K pages we need to point to, and each of those needs to have one entry in the second level table that points to them. We have 1024 of those per second level table. So we need 56 completely full second level tables to do this. And one thing we might worry about is maybe we can't completely fill one of these second level tables, but that's not a problem because the first address we're starting at is all zero is, you know, index zero of one of those second level tables. So we're going to completely fill 56 second level tables. So that's the second level, and we need one first level table which points to the second level tables. Yeah.
So when it's talking about memory requirements, so like in this case, if you're reading 24 terabytes, we should think about like that existing for the second level page table and then kind of work backwards to the requirements.
Like, so the question is, for figuring out a problem like this, you should work backwards from what's in the second level tables?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's usually how I do it. No matter how many levels you have, work backwards from the bottom and like figure out, you have a bunch of last level tables, figure out how many tables of the previous level you need to hold them, which depends on where they are, right, in general.
So would you only need a second table within the first level if you had more than 4 tables in the second level?
So the question is, we'd only need 2 second level tables?
No, sorry. What would, for, like, we only need a single first level table because, like, it hasn't, there's only 56 second level tables?
So the question is, why do we only need a single first level table? Can anyone answer this? So, yeah.
Because one first level table has 1K page table entries, so it can point to 1K second level.
So that's part of it. The other part of it is, remember how our address is split up. We have the first level part, 10 bits, and we have the second level, 10 bits. And this is, so 2 to the 10 possible first 10 bits. Possible first 10 bits. And 2 to the 10 entries in the first level table, one is always enough. There's always exactly one first level table. It always has entries for all the possible first bits. So we only always need exactly one. You can't have zero because you need to point to a second level table. The only place you can do that is the first level table. And you have to have one, and it's going to contain, always going to contain 1,024 entries, because that's the size of the table. Some of them would be invalid, typically. Yeah?
Why do we need to worry about where the addresses start?
So the question is, why do we need to worry about where the addresses start? So if I change this problem to be, instead of addresses 8 through, let's, you know, change it to addresses 80 through ... then we'd have a problem that our first second level table, that we'd have 54 full second level tables with 1K entries each, plus one second level table with all but the first entry used. I guess I should say 55 full, and plus one second level table with only the first entry used. Because basically we'll have stolen, to make this offset, we moved one page forward, so the first second level table, we had to have the first entry be invalid, and then we had to overflow onto another table. And this is probably easier to think about if we think about having 1K entries. That if you have 1K entries, you can either put that in one table, or you can put that, you know, split across two tables, depending on how it lines up. And that's why we cared where it started. Okay, so any more questions about this? Yes. So the question is, we know that we use the second level page table for that because when we actually figure out where in memory something is, we have to use the last level page table.
And we know that that's what we're looking at because it says like those are the virtual addresses that correspond to physical address.
Yeah. So to make something correspond to a physical address, we have to use the last level page table, In order to make the last level page table valid, we have to use the previous levels. So as I said, work backwards. Always start with the last level. The last level always needs to have stuff if you want things to be valid. Okay, so, and these notes are ugly. So, and then we have Q2 is probably the next, no, Q, okay. Okay, so Q2 is a simple one. So it asks, the S-break system call is used to implement malloc. And what information does the kernel actually keep track of? And most people got right that the kernel needs to keep track of the address at the end of the heap. It needs to do this because S-break's argument is the amount to move the heap by. The kernel needs to know where to allocate pages. It can't do that unless it knows where the heap already was. So one thing that people, so then there are other options. So one was this amount of the space in the heap that is currently used. The kernel doesn't, when the malloc uses space, the kernel doesn't get to learn is that space immediately used. It just knows that it allocated, you know, moved the end of the heap. That's all it knows. Malloc decides whether that space actually gets used by the program. And in particular, when you free, that doesn't mean that S-break gives space, that it calls S-break to give space back, because sometimes it can't. Like if you malloc and malloc, the heap grows twice, you free the first thing, it can't remove the heap back down, because it then would secretly free your second thing. And with the API we showed, there's no way to communicate that information that this piece in the middle is unused, so it doesn't. Option C, which most people got wrong, is that the kernel knows the physical addresses that are assigned to each virtual page in the heap. The kernel knows this because it has to set the, because it has the page table. It can look it up in the page table and will when it needs to. And it has to track that because otherwise the processor won't know. And the last one option is a linked list of free regions of the heap. The kernel doesn't know anything about the organization of the heap. All it knows is where it ends. So malloc might be tracking a linked list of free regions of the heap, but the kernel is not responsible for that. As far as it's concerned, its API is much simpler, and that was the main point of this question. We've delegated the hard parts of memory allocation to this malloc function implementation and made our kernel heap management function really simple. Okay, and last was, and question three was, a page fault, so occurs when a process tries to access a virtual address whose page table entry is invalid. If it determines that it should have been allowed, what should it do? So most people got this right. The most common confused answer was that it would access memory and then return from the page fault handler. So it is true that you could simulate the memory access in response to the fault, but if you just return from the page fault handler just doing that, then a page fault's gonna happen again. When you return from the page fault handler, it goes back to exactly what you just did, and it's gonna try it again, and that's going to fail. So if you wanted to simulate a memory access, you need to advance the program counter before you return. And also do anything else that instruction is meant to do. Like if it's an add to memory instruction, you need to simulate the rest of the instruction. Or add from memory, for example. And typically OSs don't do this because it's really annoying to simulate an arbitrary instruction. Okay, so question two. No. Used and, okay, so let's move on to our comparing. Well, first, any more questions on the quiz questions? Yeah.
All page table entries are read only.
then when something writes, how do you know that it's actually like, you actually write to it?
So the question is, if all the page tables are read-only, when something writes, how do we know that it actually writes to it? So when something writes, it's going to trigger a fault. And the OS's fault handler needs to figure out, oh, this fault wasn't because they were writing to a bad location, it's because I marked that page as read-only. And one example way that could happen is you could look up the page table entry and see, isn't marked as read-only. And assume that you did, and figure out, and hopefully remember why, you know, have some data structure to look up why you did that. So comparing scheduling methods. So I guess we had some, so we had one big classification, which was preemptive versus non-preemptive. So some scheduling methods, we just assumed that we had with preemption, where we would, you know, preemption means interrupt, you know, stop whatever's happening when we want to schedule something else. Anything else? No preemption means just keep going until the thread gives up the CPU itself. So that was a big category difference. So, and we had our, and sort of our simplest version was round robin, which is that we just choose the next thing on the list after every time slice. And the simplest version without preemption was first come, first served, where we just choose the next thing on the list, but only when something actually was done with the CPU, couldn't do any more right now. So then we had a bunch of scheduling methods which optimized, you know, for something. So we had optimizing for throughput was generally first come, first served. This was because minimum overhead. Fewest context switches, simplest scheduling decisions. So that optimized for overhead because minimized overhead, so that should optimize throughput. We get the most actual work done on the CPU. We waste the least time doing operating system stuff that the user doesn't really care about. They just want their program to run. For response time, sort of, which was, you know, making, you know, key press happens, do something, was we had, you know, theoretically we had SJF for no preemption or SRTF for preemption. And these were designed to choose the thing which, you know, needed to happen first to minimize our response time. Basically, run the thing that will finish first. Yes. Shortest remaining time first. I think our book sometimes conflates that a bit with shortest job first. But I'm using the separate name to point out that you can't just take the total length of the thing. You need to take how much time is left when you have interruptions. And practically speaking, you can't do that. So we had practically multi-level feedback queues. And I probably should just break that out. Queues, which was, you know, figure out the CPU burst time based on history. So that tried to optimize for response time, but it's heuristic, so it's not guaranteed to actually work. Okay, so then we had some other metrics. So we had, you know, importance as told by user. So we had priority scheduling, which is user tells us, you know, users or admins, sysadmins tell us and say what order order, and this is run the most important one first, always. Now you have a list of their priority, their importance. You always run the most important one, no matter what. We had our proportional share, which was user sysadmin, say, relative importance, and run in specified ratio. This is what lottery and CFS, one of the things CFS tries to do. And I guess we also had fairness. So round robin, just runs, has no ordering, just evenly split the time, and is arguably fair, but doesn't give you credit for coming back, not using the CPU after a while, which is maybe something we want to do. And CFS was fairness, but with proportional share, if you wanted it, and tries to give you credit if you haven't used the CPU for a while. That was something the completely fair scheduler did, is it tried to say, if you haven't used the CPU for a while, you deserve more for a little bit. Yeah?
In what context does CFS optimize fairness? So we said it's a short-term
or long-term. So CFS is, it's probably medium term is the better answer. Like in the really short term, it kind of tries to, it's willing to give you credit for having, give you like excess time for having not used the CPU for a little bit in the past. So it depends what you call short term, but like on the order of, like it has these rounds, remember. It tries to run everything like every so many milliseconds. And over a couple rounds, over like, two or three rounds, it seems like things probably balance out. But like over one, it like does favor things like more than round robin does. Round robin just always, like if you look at any short period of time or lottery with even wait tickets, does something different. But over the very long term, like it, remember, it limited how much credit you got for not using the CPU. So in some sense, it's not fair over the long term, but like this is not a unambiguous thing because remember we said that defining fairness was very hard. Like if I have a process which doesn't need much CPU, what does it mean to schedule it fairly? Do you just run it immediately when it wants the CPU? Is that fair? That's hard to say. Like you could come up with definitions where you say yes or no. So I'll put approximate fairness, fairness. Okay, so the completely fair scheduler was deterministic proportional share. Instead of tickets, track, time, tech, CPU time units used, weighted by importance, weighted by relative importance. And gives some credit, limit how far ahead a process gets in CPU time units used by not using the CPU for a while. Sorry, track CPU time used, typically run process with the least time units used. But you limit how far processes can get ahead, because if a process goes to sleep for an A, you don't want to give it a minute of CPU time to compensate for that. Okay, so any questions on scheduling? Anything I probably missed? I guess there's one category I didn't cover that we mentioned. So we had real-time guarantees, and I'm sure I'm misspelling this word. Okay, I'm misspelling a lot of words. So just not that one apparently. Okay, so real-time guarantees, we wanted something like earliest deadline first. First, and this is not the same as, you know, response time. Because it's not guaranteed the thing with the first deadline is the thing that can be done quickest, which is what response time is saying. We do the thing which can be done quickest first, because that will make things overall fast as they can be if you take like the mean response time. But, you know, real for deadlines, that doesn't mean that that's actually the most important thing. Okay. So any other question, any questions on scheduling? Okay, so cache coherency. So our big idea is every CPU has a cache, has a cache. Caches are connected via a shared bus, shared wire, basically. CPUs track information about everything they have cached. Either it's modified, meaning, which means they have the only copy, and it may be different from memory, or shared means they may or may not have the only copy. Right, this is others may have copies, and it's the same as memory. And, you know, the key problem is want the modified state to really mean only you have it. Because we want to ensure that when we're changing something, no one else actually sees the wrong version of that while that's happening. No one sees the old version as we're updating it. So the key property is that we want to ensure that when we say something is modified, that we are the only ones who have the modified version until we're done. And the way we ensure that is we, you know, cause everyone else to evict their copy when we want to modify something. So this is send a message, please invalidate this address. I am about to write to it. And make sure anyone reading a modified value sees our update before they finish the read. So somehow send out the value we have cached before they finish the read. And when they do that, we don't keep the value marked as modified. Because we're not the only ones who have it, we can't keep changing it. So another way of looking at modified is equal to license to change a value. You have it in the modified state, you're allowed to change it. If you don't, you are not. It's the only way with cache coherency you're allowed to edit memory. This keeps us from having some write just go away. As far as the cache is concerned, we've learned about ways that can happen with like threads where just the order, like one write happens then another. But at least if like you write to part of a cache block, another processor writes to another part of a cache block, this guarantees that both of those things happen. So questions about this? We're not getting to the right part of the topic. That's confused people. Yeah.
There was a part we talked about, I think it was on a visible point, about how if something is modified and it's modified again, it doesn't update anywhere else, it waits until somebody has to read that information.
Yes, so can keep changing a value without sending messages. So once you make something marked as modified, once you've done the work, you know, so already done the work to make sure no one else has it. So once you've made sure no one else has it, you can keep changing the value without telling them, because you know that they don't care. Yeah?
So for the ones that are invalid, does the modifier have to send this?
So the question is, for the ones that are invalid, so is it, if a cache block is invalid, we consider it not cached. And maybe I should have expressed things that way. But it's considered not cached. Like typically when a cache marks something as invalid, it also clears the tagments. Or doesn't care what the tagments are.
Does it snoop the bus to get the mean value?
So the question is, does it snoop the bus to get the mean value? This is unspecified. But note with modified that we typically won't see a new value yet until it's not modified anymore. So that doesn't actually help us. Until the value becomes not modified, the processor has no reason to write out the new value to the bus. Yeah?
So at what point does that new value that the modified version has updated, when does that get updated in all of the others?
So there's two cases. So one is this case where someone else is trying to read the value, we're going to have to write it back. The other case is if we run out of room in the cache, we're going to need to write it back.
Is that different from memory or from the one that has the modified?
So the question is, where is it read from? I deliberately didn't specify that because processors do both. But we have to ensure that somehow the value gets sent back before we allow the processor to finish reading it. So we have some mechanism in this shared wire to say, no, your read's not done yet. Other questions? Yeah.
Other than for the cache that has a modified value, where else could the write come from?
So other than the cache which has modified value, where else can you write? So if you want to write and you don't, and you're not the one who has it modified, you need to send a message on the bus to state your intention to write it. So this is, if a value's been updated and you're reading it, where do you read it from is the question. Do you read it from memory, or do you read it directly from the person who just modified it? And the answer is either could work. Obviously, it needs to get to memory eventually, and it needs to get to memory for the processor when the processor figures that out. But it's unspecified whether it goes to memory, then you read it from memory, or whether you notice, oh, it's writing this value to memory, I'll just use that too. Both are valid things to do, and processors do both of them. One of them requires you to implement a little extra logic. Basically. Okay. So other questions about cache? Okay. So spin lock implementation is that the basic idea is, have a memory location represents the lock. One value means locked. One does not, and lock is use an atomic operation to try to set from unlocked to locked. If atomic operation says it was already locked, then retry. And unlock is set from locked to unlocked. And there's different atomic operations you can use to do them, but the pattern's always the same. Use an atomic operation to set it to locked from unlocked, and that atomic operation is going to be, must be read, modify, write, because you need to read the old value. So the atomic operation is going to be something which lets you read the old value and write a new value. So you can make sure that you're the one who changed it to lock, not someone else. And the unlock is that. And there's lots of atomic operations. Operations that work. So we had test and set, atomic exchange, which was typical V6 choice, compare and swap, which is really, which was a conditional right. There's a lot of atomic operations which work, but for a spin lock, the key property we're using is that they let us learn what the value was beforehand as we were trying to set it to a new value. Yeah, I guess I should say some values mean locked, some do not. Like you can choose different things depending on what atomic operations you have. So any questions on spin lock implementation? Yeah?
Can you go over the atomic exchange?
So atomic exchange is register, memory, address is that atomically temp becomes memory at the memory address. The register, I'll probably write this as that notation, the register, the memory at the memory address becomes the register value, and the register value then becomes the temp. So this is like a swap between a register and a memory location, but it's atomic. Meaning that guaranteed atomically, meaning that no one can write the memory location while this is happening. Which remember with cache coherency means that we put the cache block in the modified state so we know no other processors using it.
Okay, so this comes in when you are writing to or changing the lock value.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So mutex versus spin lock. So spin lock, we had this spin lock, we had this retry. Retry, which is keep running instructions on the CPU until it works. With a mutex, we tell the OS, hey, run something else. Else I can't go. Can't go. And the unlock operation tells the OS, hey, this guy can go now. This thread can go. So the mutex is, you know, instead of writing this retry loop, I just say, I can't do anything right now. I tell the OS, hey, run something else. I am not useful. And to make that work, we need the unlock operation to tell the OS, hey, this thing that put itself to sleep earlier can go now. Typical implementation uses something, spin locks or similar to handle information about who needs to be woken up on unlock. So we need to track who do I tell the OS to wake up on unlock. We'll use spin locks or something like that to track that information, to keep that information, you know, safe, even though multiple threads and therefore multiple cores are accessing it. Questions on that? Yeah?
When you say the spin lock keeps running instructions, is that instructions?
Keep running instructions for this thread.
Okay.
You know, even though those instructions won't do anything useful for a while. So usually the assumption with spin locks is that retry period should be pretty short. Like, you'd like, you know, typical OS that spin locks are like held for like 50 cycles or something like that. Something nice and where you don't really have enough time to tell the OS schedule something else. So, semaphores versus monitors. So, and implementing them with each other. So the first rule is that these are equally powerful. Put monitors equals mutexes condition variables. Equally powerful can implement either with the other. So they can do all the same stuff. The way you think about them is a bit different. So semaphores, you know, we have a sort of, we have two big patterns, two important patterns, which are sort of want to make a thread go, you know, have a wait for event is start semaphore at one, at zero, waiting thread calls down, event detecting thread calls up, and mutex lock, which is start sem at one, lock is down, unlock is up. So like those are the two big patterns you see with semaphores, mutex, monitors, wait for event, done with condition variables, which have a signal broadcast threads that are currently waiting, whereas monitors is don't need waiting thread to start before event detecting thread for that to work. Threads that are currently waiting, and these have spurious wake up, which means we, and other reasons that we have threads sneaking in, so generally have a loop checking shared data to see if we can go, which with semaphores can be less necessary. And we have a mutex lock, which is a mutex. So they have the same operations that you can do with either. They're just different in that way. So as for implementing a monitor with semaphores, the key idea, so you can use the mutex lock pattern above, sem at one, lock equals down, unlock equals up, list of wait for event pattern for condition variables. So we can just have a vector, like a linked list of those wait for event semaphores to handle the other part of it. That's my super quick high level sketch of that, of how you do that implementation. Any questions about that? Yeah. So, sorry, with the... So do I also need to use another monitor? So the these lists are probably going to be protected by a mutex lock style semaphore, is how you do that. So when a semaphore, when someone starts waiting with this implementation, you lock something that represents the condition variable, adjust the list, unlock it, and you know that either you were, and since you're holding the main lock while doing that, you typically, you know that you don't have a synchronization issue there. So when an event when you notice an event happens, when do I use this wait for event pattern? Like when is the event detected?
Yeah.
The event detected, that is, it is signal or broadcast. Like that's the event we're waiting for. So the wait is wait for someone to call signal or broadcast. The event we're detecting is someone calls signal or broadcast. So when someone calls signal or broadcast, if they call signal, we look at that list, and we choose one of the semaphores and we use the up operation on it. If it's broadcast, we look at that list, we go through every single one and use the up operation on it. And also, as we're doing that, we remove it from the list because we don't want to use it multiple times. If the thread wants to do that, they need to start waiting again and add themselves to the list again with a new semaphore. Any more questions on? Yes. Okay. So shockingly, I'm not out of time. So I will take another round of any questions. Yeah.
So there are some differences between this section and Pyrosoft section, but you guys are running the tests together. What should we consider?
So the question is, we're writing the test together. It's probably more accurate to say that we may incidentally share test questions. It turns out that Grimshaw and I have pretty different opinions on what makes a good exam. So that might result in different exams. Also, we did cover some different stuff. For example, Grimshaw's class covers a virtual memory, started with a very different part of virtual memory than we did. Grimshaw covered semaphores in more detail than we did, so it makes sense to ask different questions in that respect. Yes, as you say, Grimshaw covered semaphores in more detail and monitors in less detail. But I'm not sure, tentatively, it doesn't look like we'll be sharing that many questions. But we'll see. There's some of the questions which would be fine to bring back, depending on how I feel about time. Yes?
Could we expect the same level of quizzes
Okay, versus quizzes. I probably should just collect all the questions. So, versus. Yeah, so are there questions? I'll just try to collect a list of questions. Yeah.
I don't really get what's going on in the back end information very well.
Yeah. What does the implementation look like? Yeah. Deadlocks. Anything more specific or just definition? Deadlocks aren't, compare them to? Okay, we'll do a def, okay. Anything else? Yeah.
Can we go about how to create atomic operations?
Creating atomic operations?
Yeah, like we
have some example
class
of using atomic operations? Like doing something useful with atomic read, modify, write operations, like atomic exchange? Okay.
How much should we expect about event based loops?
Event loops. Okay. Yeah.
Is there any place we can find sample questions for?
Okay. Sample questions. Okay. So that's probably event loops. Atomic op. I assume like seems to do something. It's probably what's not. Any other thing? Yes?
Test and set.
Okay. Yeah.
Is there going to be a scale I can pop on?
So, okay. Okay. Okay, so versus quizzes. Quizzes are typical of questions I write, but many quiz questions assume you can look at the slide, assume you will look at slides, which I'm not obviously not going to assume on the exam. Especially like this week's quiz questions, you know, assume that you would look things up and do calculations, you know. They weren't meant to be answered from memory, even though that's possible that was not the intention of those questions, but they are typical questions I write in format and difficulty otherwise. Sample questions, besides quiz questions, if you want some practice questions, are in the exercises in the textbook book, so either Anderson Dahlin or Andre, I can't spell the name of our other textbook. I probably should just use the abbreviation. Right, Arpachi Nassau. Both have exercises. Arpachi Nassau is the PDF online. The other one is the one you recommended. So that would be one place if you want sample questions to go through. They're probably different than the format we'll ask in the exam, but they're typical of sort of the material we expect you to know. Okay, so rubric, I intend to adjust to figure to deal with this when I map raw weighted scores to letter grades. If you read carefully in the grading policies, I never specified how numerical scores map to letter grades, and that is deliberate. So I intend to deal with, were my exams too hard at that time in the class rather than when I give the exam. Yes?
Are there answer keys for the practice questions in the textbooks?
Probably not. They are often more open-ended than that. So, like, they're often like exercises that like would involve writing a little bit of code, but like they're typical of things where you might construct a question that's based on that sort of thing. Like, probably it would be easier to grade. Like, we supply some code or something like that, but until you like fill in the blanks or something, but you know, or ask you a question about it, but. Yes, I don't think there are widely available answer keys for them,
okay.
Or should not be. So what does the implementation of a CV look like? So we need to have a wait queue, like for, so a queue of waiting threads, like for a mutex. We need to do some sort of mutual exclusion when changing this queue, like for a mutex. And the difference is that rather than unlocking doing it, the signal and broadcast look at queue and tell OS to wake up. Yeah. And there's some sort of mutual exclusion, there's spin lock, maybe. There might be other ways, depending on how the OS wait system call works. Yeah, spin lock. OS system call for going to sleep till woken up. So deadlocks is one thread is holding a resource while another thread is waiting to acquire that resource, while it is waiting to acquire a resource another thread has, but that other thread is waiting for one thread, it's waiting to acquire a resource another thread B has, but thread B is waiting for a resource that thread C is waiting for. Thread C is waiting for a resource that some thread D has, and all the way to some last letter, you know, thread D, which is waiting for a resource thread it has. So we have a, so this is a, so these are our conditions. So it's hold and wait, and we have a circular dependency. Those are, and we have limited, some limited resources. I have a feeling I forgot one of the conditions I listed down, though I'm not a fan of memorizing what is a deadlock in that way. Even though that is a common thing people like asking, it's just, what are the end the conditions for a deadlock? But I will look up on my slides to make sure I remember. I will look up on the correct day slides to make sure I remember what all the conditions I listed in the slides were. And hold and wait, and of course, and no preemption, can't steal resources. What's the other condition you mentioned? It's a way you could avoid it. Okay, questions on definition of deadlock? I had this like long list of threads. It could just be A and B waiting on each other. So we have these resource graphs, you know, circular dependency, draw a resource, you know, what we call the resource acquisition graph. There's a cycle, you know, X is X hole, you know, where we have edges from resource to thread holding, from thread waiting to resource. Okay, so event loops, we're not gonna like have you do code, but you should know the basic concept of like what is an event loop, why would you care? So event loop is instead of multiple threads to do IO to multiple things, e.g. multiple network connections, use one thread, have a get event, next event call that returns which thing has, you know, input available or can accept output. And this has a very different code organization. Need to track some table of connection map to the, you know, information about what's going on, like what command active, that sort of thing. And this, the advantage was, the pro was, we no synchronization problems. The con is possibly harder to program, in spite of that, you know, harder, less natural to program. And, you know, what if, e.g., need to avoid stalling this thread, the event stalling on any operation, and the other con is you can't use multiple cores. Okay, so test and set. So test and set takes a memory address and atomically, you know, old value goals memory at the memory address, and memory at the memory address equals 1 and return old. That's what it does. So it sets, reads the value, sets it to one, no matter what it was before, or it's true or whatever, and returns the old value. And this is probably the simplest atomic operation you can use to implement a spin lock. It's not the one I showed you because x86 doesn't have this instruction. But it does exactly what we need for a spin lock, which is it reads the old value and writes a value we can call locked. We'll just say one is locked, zero is unlocked. Okay, and general pattern for atomic operations, since people, which I think is the conclusion, is that we use an atomic operation to try to do something. To try atomic read, modify, write operation to try to do something. Detect from read value whether it worked right, e.g., did we acquire the lock, or was it already locked? Did we use, did compare and swap, locked, did compare and swap update the value to increment it, or did someone else change it first? Did we add to the linked list, or did someone else where we thought, or did someone else change the next pointer first? You know, those sorts of questions are you're going to answer with the atomic operation. And that's the general pattern for using them. So which means typically a loop that loops as potentially loops forever if other threads keep trying to change the value too. Yes?
So if thread does sneak in there while you're trying to do an atomic operation, so then you try to do it again, that thread's operation just forgotten.
So it depends what atomic operation we use. So if it's something like atomic exchange, which I have atomic exchange, then our operation also does something. And we need to ensure that the thing it does in the bad case is not a problem. So one example is for lock, if we're exchanging locked and locked, we don't care, but we weren't successful. Or for a linked list update, if we're exchanging our next pointer with a new next pointer, what we need to do is we need to say, oh, that was a different next pointer than I expected. I need to handle making sure that list element doesn't go away. Or with compare and swap, for example, if you remember the description of that, compare and swap checks what the old value was before allowing the write to happen. So in that case, we'll learn, oh, I didn't actually write. I didn't actually change anything, so it's okay that it fails. But yes, we need to pay attention to what happens if it doesn't work. And tip, one way of doing this is you make sure that, you know, if it doesn't work, you're writing the same value you would have written anyways. Another way is to use an atomic operation, which if it doesn't work, if the value isn't what you expected, doesn't do anything, like compare and swap. And if you don't have options like that for your particular problem, then you might not be able to use that atomic operation to do it. It's sort of the answer. Like, if you don't have something like compare and swap, there are things you just can't do without waiting and using something more like a mutex or a spin lock. Okay, so that's what I have. So see you on Thursday. I have office hours tomorrow if you want to stop by. More questions?